Welcome to A Rabbi and a Lawyer Walk into a Bar, a podcast with relatively well-informed and irreverent musings on religion, news, and society. And now, for your hosts, Rabbi Asher Lopatin and John Gerringer.
Hey, Asher.
Hey, John. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm tired. I just drove 5 hours today. Actually, my wife drove 5 hours today while I was reading a good book while taking my kid to college. And you took your kid to college as well this week, right?
Yeah, I guess, you know, two we sent off to Israel, gap years. And well, one is at Michigan. Yeah, it's only 45 minutes, convenient to Detroit, only 45 minutes. But still, yeah, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. How do you feel?
Well, I can't believe we're old enough to send kids to college. I feel like I just left myself.
I know. But, you know, it's a little bit of a culture shock. I loved college. Did you like college? Was that a good, those were good years?
They absolutely were. You know, being a poli-sci student in DC is like having a backstage pass to a U2 concert. Yeah, you know, all the internships and things like that. I'm trying to picture, though, you in college. It's kind of like a superhero origin story. I want to hear what you were doing for fun. Did you have fun? Are you allowed to have fun? Weren't you called Andrew too? Are you Andrew? Are you Asher? What were you?
Well, you know, my English name is Andrew. So when we moved to Israel, I was Asher. So when we came back, I was mostly Asher. And then at college, you know, you have to fill out the forms, Andrew. So my teachers knew me as Andrew. It was a little confusing, but in general, in the Hillel world, where I spent hours and hours every day, I was like, you know, a Hillel nerd. I was there all the time. That it was always Asher. But for my classes, Andrew, so I have some very dear, Christian friends who they know me as Andrew, but pretty much Asher, I think, pretty much Asher. But, you know, honestly, you know, that's the thing about college. It's really you have to understand your own identity as a Jew, as a person of the world, or as a non-Jew. Or, you know, I lived right near Newman House, was sort of the Hillel house for Catholics. So Newman House was like a little brownstone where we understood that's sort of where the Catholic folks hung out at Boston University. So I love college because it's really a place where you get to understand who you are and you get to mix the Andrew and the Asher, so to speak.
Yeah, and that's when I first started becoming more Shomer Shabbat, observant of the Sabbath. And for example, my college roommate, Pat Keeley, would help me walk down to a movie theater, pay for my movie on Friday nights. And that was the compromise that we made. It worked out pretty well. And then one of my roommates, the general I mentioned earlier, Mark Klingon, would open up his window and yell at the top of his lungs, "It's Shabbos!"
That's cool. Well, that's great.
Loved it.
It's really an incredible thing when people that we love, whether they're not religious Jews or into it, or whether or not Jewish at all. And when they sort of support our own aspect, religious aspect of our lives, I think that's so powerful. And so it's cheating a little bit because it wasn't in college, it was just post-college, but I went with my friend Rob Radke to India, and we were in Cochin, beautiful little small Jewish community at the time. This is 30 years ago, and we were sitting with the elders of the Jewish community in Cochin, and I was being eaten alive by mosquitoes. There's an issue of killing animals on Shabbat and even mosquitoes. I wasn't going to swat them, but my dear friend Rob was swatting the mosquitoes on me like crazy. It was such a mitzvah. So, you know, that's sort of like your movie story, kind of.
Yeah, so you started off, didn't you want to go into the State Department?
Yeah, you know, I started taking Arabic because I knew some French. I actually took French at Maimonides.
Très bien.
I learned, yeah, très bien. J'aime beaucoup la langue française. I knew Hebrew, I knew English. So I, you know, get to know all the languages of the Middle East. And actually, later on, we visited Morocco again in graduate school. I did use French because, you know, they speak French there and Arabic, of course. But so I started just sort of languages. But then I had a wonderful professor, Merlin Swartz, who not only was a great professor of Arabic, but he brought our class together. And we had one of the It's interesting because you're now at DePaul.
Chicago Kent is where I teach. I went to DePaul Law School.
Okay. I keep on thinking, Chicago Kent. Okay. But you went to DePaul Law School. And in my class, Arabic class, there was an Egyptian named Khalid Kishk. His last name was not the Jewish Kishka, you know, but Kishk. And his father was Sheikh Kishk in Egypt, was a major fundamentalist whose writings were all over the streets of Cairo. But Khalid is now a professor, or at least when I was in Chicago, was a professor at DePaul.
Is that right?
Wonderful guy. And he came over for Shabbat dinner. You know, so it's really in an undergraduate. I felt that there was a theme of you can study Arabic and study Islamic studies, because that's what I majored in. And yet that makes you a better Jew. It doesn't make you any less of a Jew. It makes you a more whole Jew and a more whole human being. I really felt that kind of mixing and mixing with, you know, with Muslims and with Christians, and that makes you more Jewish, you know, a more complete Jew. So it really was. I think that, you know, as much as people talk about the dangers of university life and, you know, all the temptations and all that, I don't flatter myself. I wasn't tempted, you know, I had opportunities. I never thought I did. But, you know, it's great. Really a great experience and I continue to have that philosophy of shared society, even for Israel. We'll get into it at some point, of Muslims and Jews. John, I got to say one more thing. Nas Daily, I don't know if you follow, there was an article in the New York Times. He's like a hero of mine. He's an Israeli-Palestinian, and he has 60 million followers. He was doing once a day, like 1 minute on the internet, whatever it was on.
And we're almost at that number.
Exactly. We're getting there. It says that we do it once a week, so we don't get, you know, but so he's really into this mixed society and people coming together. So for me, that was my college experience, I would say, even though I spent like sometimes 8 hours a day at Hillel and, you know, just hanging out there and being the president or being the this and that, you know, it did feel like an experience of really broadening myself. And what was your major, John?
I was poli-sci and international. So basically soaking up everything Washington, D.C. had to offer. And that's the good stuff. And dancing in a cage in Adams Morgan, for those of you who know Washington, D.C. So there was the other side of being in Washington. That was a ton of fun as well. You know, kind of I'm thinking in my head like that famous Animal House scene. You know, the studious Usher, and then on the other side of the shoulder, the crazy Andrew, you know, is going to be the new metaphor, I think, for
that. Crazy John.
Yeah. Right, Crazy John and interning on the Hill John, right? Well, exactly.
It's so interesting. I don't know what we've talked about. I felt a little guilty. So when I was applying for my Rhodes Scholarship, I, you know, talked about my dream was this, bringing peace to the Middle East and being a State Department think tank, whatever it was, policy planning. And eventually, you know, I became a rabbi, but thank God that's how we met, you know. And I felt, you know, look, is my agenda as broad as it would be to make, you know, to be Daniel Kurtzer or Dennis Ross or all these people who, I don't know, maybe messed up the Middle East, but, or, you know, all those, you know. But and now I'm kind of full circle because I have a small, wonderful synagogue here in Detroit, but I'm also doing Jewish relations with Muslims and with the African-American community, the Hindu community. I mean, it's fascinating, the Catholic community. So it's, and John, you also went into law and now you're also like an academic side, really, back into the underpinnings of political science and all the legal stuff that you do as far as law of war and that kind of stuff.
It's funny that both of us could have met in two different parallel universes. And doesn't Judaism have a view of parallel universes that could exist at the same time?
Yeah, well, the Zohar, our mysticism is about thousands of worlds that exist and are influenced by the smallest actions that we do. If we say hello in a kind way to someone, you know, someone on the street, someone homeless or something, you know, we can get into that, give them money or not, but you say hello to them. And I had that experience this week. I was in the car, so I couldn't even, you know, but I waved to someone who, you know, was in a really difficult. So that affects, you're right, these parallel universes and powers them and makes them move. So you're right.
Because I think there's a universe out there where you and I would have met, you at State Department, me at the Department of Defense, and we would have done something just as interesting together as we're doing now. But I'm happy where we are. No complaints. I love this universe, but it'd be interesting to think about those parallel universes and how we would have connected there too.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal about like how amazing Kissinger and Shultz and James Baker were as, you know, incredible secretaries of state. And I don't know, you know, I'm not sure that really we could have quite a debate, certainly about Kissinger and James Baker. Shultz is a tzaddik, is a righteous man. But sometimes if you're just that, you have that power and you're, you know, influencing policy, I don't know, maybe I wouldn't trust myself with that. Get into a lot of trouble.
All I know is I was studying terrorism in the late 80s, early 90s, before it was cool.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, and I was studying Said Qutb. I started my thesis about him. He was an Egyptian fundamentalist, but Aina is definitely, they're students of his, you know, and do you know what?
Didn't Said Qutb do a tour in the 50s in the United States?
That really turned him off to Western culture. Yeah,
he saw how we danced and all that decadence, and that sent him back to Egypt, right?
Yeah, exactly. That really made him a fundamentalist. And that's the innocent 50s. That was like, I don't know, that was we look upon that as a much more, you know, innocent time, which it really was.
Can you imagine how he see what's going on college campuses today?
Yes, it's, you know, I just hope that students really try to just be themselves and are not trying to conform. I think, you know, I don't know. It's tough being a student, you know. On the one hand, it's the great life, you know. Now we're talking about student loan forgiveness and all that. It's so amazing to be a student and just to not worry about anything, take out loans and whatever. There is something, John, I don't know what you say, like, especially now we're getting closer to Russia, to the Jewish New Year, to think about how great is we have a life where we actually can make an impact on the world. You know, and I guess when you're a student, you imagine you can also, but we really, you know, can make a difference.
Well, I think a lot of folks don't quite understand. I didn't understand until relatively recently about the run-up to Rosh Hashanah in the month of the Hebrew month of Elul, right? And so it's Rosh Hashanah for many people is the ultimate pinnacle as to, you know, now is the time where you're supposed to be repenting and saying you're sorry to all the people that you've wronged over the last year. But really that process started on Rosh Chodesh Elul, the first day of Elul, which we just encountered last night. And so talk to us about what that run-up needs to look like. And there's something called a cheshbon hanefesh. It's sort of an accounting of the soul. It's pretty heady stuff. But
yeah.
Talk to us about how we're supposed to be thinking about Elul and how, you know, Rosh Hashanah is sort of the end of the process, not the beginning.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And right before I do that, I have to say that, you know, this is a rabbi and a lawyer going to a bar. So we both have some really delicious scotch, single malt scotch. You know what?
I'm drinking a delicious Lagavulin, which is my favorite. And I think your favorite too. And I'm drinking it in a glass that I got at a reception called the Whiskey Jubilee, J-E-W, Jubilee. Mm-hmm. And it was scotch and steaks. So l'chaim to you.
L'chaim. I mean, it shows how, you know, it's fascinating. You can, even with all the restrictions that Jews have, you can have a good time with steak. And I imagine, again, other religions, you know, I read about, I don't get to do it, but flying first class in some of the dry airlines, Saudi and Etihad, I think, and Qatar, I think might be a dry, you could still have a good time. So steak and scotch is pretty good.
Well, I once had one of the worst possible experiences is that I was upgraded to first class, but it was Passover, so I couldn't drink anything.
Oh, pain.
At least nothing alcoholic.
That was good. That was your temptation. That was your test. That was
I don't think they had kosher for Passover anything on that flight.
So there is something actually that parallels drinking a good scotch. And by the way, I have a Glenlivet, a 14-year-old Glenlivet from cognac, not cognac itself, but steeped in cognac barrels. And we can talk about that. That's a whole question. Isn't cognac made from grapes? And isn't that a problem with wine? We'll talk about that and talk about the London Bethine, the London court that allows it. But what a really good scotch is, and I imagine with any kind of drink, is that you're not supposed to chug-a-lug it, right? You do it very slowly and you let it permeate and you let it, you know, spread little sips at a time. And cheshbon ha-nefesh, these times, the idea is before Rosh Hashanah, before the new year, to kind of slow down and think about, to step back, really to step back and to think about, not to run through life and just do this and do that, and really to think about the impact of what we've done. There's someone was teaching me, and when I remember their name for next time, I will mention it. But the beautiful idea of ruminants. So I'm going to ruminate, to think about. Ruminants are animals that chew their cud, that are kosher because they regurgitate their food and chew it and then swallow it many, many times. And that, he said, was an interesting idea, that that's sort of what we should be doing these days. We should really be thinking of, you know, what I did, what I said yesterday, was that the right thing or the wrong thing? Now, sometimes maybe we over-process things, but these days, like you're talking about, really to take an account of what we've done, to really think about it and in some ways slow down a little bit and take it all in and really like drinking a fine scotch, to do things really very carefully and thoughtfully and to add those thoughts. So that's sort of what I'm thinking about this time of year. I mean, ideally, then I'll say something, I don't know, something Rachel will tell me, you know, I didn't say something as nicely as I could, but the ideal is to really try to think about what you do and to put a lot more thought into what you're doing. And that will get you hopefully to do the right thing and to change perhaps the way we've been doing things.
It also reminds me, there was a rabbi who told a story about this time of year. It's as if the king leaves his castle and goes out to the fields. You know, just like God out there among us, you know, hearing our prayers maybe a little bit more closely than before. And it reminds me of a great story of a mutual friend of ours who, when Vice President Bush at the time, so this is when he was in high school, came to his school at Ida Crown Jewish Academy to campaign and felt like he could basically reproach Bush about his support or lack thereof for Israel. And, you know, basically three times asked him the same question. And he thought his teachers were going to absolutely rake him across the coals. And then it turned out later he was fine from his teachers. But, you know, it reminds me of that same notion that here you are, you know, the sitting vice president coming out there into, you know, campaign land and listening to what the constituents has to say. It reminds me of this notion of king/God out there a little bit more approachable during Elul.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, I think that, and I know that Shmuley Boteach, Rabbi Boteach, has mentioned this. I'm sure many others have before, after, whatever, that the name Yisrael that the Jews have is that we argue, we fight, we Elohim, we fight with God sometimes. You know, when God comes closer, God's probably nervous because we have a lot of things then we want to challenge God about, you know, people that are dying that are so innocent, whether it's from disease, whether it's from wars, you know, it just people, you know, suffering people, you know, whether it's, you know, Ukrainians being oppressed, whether it's the Uyghurs or the Rohingya or in all over in Libya. So we want, you know, it's a time for us to really connect with God, but not in a way of only of reverence. We have to have reverence for God in our tradition, but it's also arguing with God. God is much closer. And so it's sort of like a three-way argument. It's arguing with ourselves, arguing with bringing God into that, and really a very hopefully thoughtful time that's really gonna change the way we're doing things and change the way the world is doing things. And You know, John, I hope that our kids are getting a little bit of that from college. I don't know. Do you feel they are? Your kid's going to Wash U. Jake's at Wash U. It's a fine university.
Yeah, he's engaged. You know, first of all, a quarter of the kids are Jewish. He's engaged with Chabad there. And then he goes out. They have what are called Jewish parties or jardies on Friday night. So I feel like, you know, he is engaged in that community. I don't pry too much how much, but he is to a significant degree, and that's all we can expect from him in college. What he decides to do later, you know, I'll put on him.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Shayna is loves Michigan, and she's taking some great courses, but I got a lot out of it. So, you know, we're paying the tuition, even though it's, thank God, it's in-state, but we're paying it because she took a course about the history of the 60s. And I'm a baby boomer. I was born in 64. And she wanted to know about my life in the 60s. And I could tell, you know, I could tell her about the hippies. We grew up in Berkeley, near Berkeley, in Orinda, and hippies and drugs and all those things. And it was so fascinating because of this class that she had, I Googled, you know, there was a fire when I was, again, 5 years old. So I don't know, it was 69 or 70, maybe 71. There was a fire across the way. And apparently it's because the people there were boiling LCD. Is it, what is it?
LSD.
LSD. I can't remember LSD. Sorry.
I'm so glad you don't know what it is.
So LSD, but then I looked it up. So I wanted to find the story of the house that burnt down in Orinda because of LSD. And I couldn't find that, but I did Google it. And Orinda, my sleepy suburb where I grew up till I was 8 years old, is like the LSD capital of California. Some of the greats who invented LSD and popularized it,
even the Gadol Hadors, the leaders of the generation on LSD came from
Orinda. I got a lot out of Shayna's class. I was very excited about that.
So you could have definitely taken a different direction.
Yeah, you know, I don't know, what we moved to Israel when I was 8. You never know what I would have been like. We also were not it wasn't a heavily Jewish environment. We would go to synagogue in Berkeley, but I wonder what would have happened had we stayed in that area. You know, I don't know. It's, you know, nature versus nurture, and you know how we would have turned out. Speaking of hippies,
I can't wait to see where this is going.
We have not talked about Ben and Jerry's ice cream.
We have not. It's interesting, as we were planning the podcast, the Ben and Jerry's story just took its toll over a series of months. And now here we are toward the end of the saga, it seems.
Yeah. I hope it's really the end of the saga. And first of all, it's frustrating because Ben and Jerry's brand makes a great non-dairy kosher ice cream that you can serve for dessert on your meat meal after your meat meal on Shabbat. So it was Ben and Jerry's was like a regular at our Shabbat table.
Look, we're not arguing about how great their ice cream is / was. It was fantastic, but I won't touch it again. Maybe let's take a step back in history. So around 2000, Unilever buys Ben & Jerry's, but allows them to have an independent board for their social issues. But Unilever maintains control over financial and operational issues. So fast forward to last summer, right? They basically tell the local licensee of Ben & Jerry's, a guy named Avi Zinger. I love the name. What a zinger. Avi Zinger, that this license won't be renewed. Why? Because it's an OPT, sort of a new expression for me, occupied Palestinian territories. And we can spend a whole class on Judea, Samaria, West Bank, what all that means. But some variation of that plot of land. And then, of course, people like me were up in arms, notwithstanding how great their ice cream is, because it sounded like it passed the test for, remember Natan Sharansky, the famous refusenik who became an Israeli minister, basically said he had a three-part test for anti-Semitism. It was going to involve some combination of dehumanization, double standards, or delegitimization, basically the three Ds. Mm-hmm. Which in my mind is a lot better definition than what the IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, has as their definition. But anyway, it seemed to pass that test.
We'll talk about that another time. Yes,
yeah, exactly.
Like that.
Right. So that happens. And then there's a lawsuits back and forth. And Unilever said it would then sell its license to Zinger, but he could only use it in Hebrew and Arabic. And then, of course, the Ben and Jerry's side of it, right? We have the Unilever at the top. We have the Ben and Jerry's board on the other side, sued in the Southern District of New York in the federal court there, and said that, you know, this Unilever settlement basically violated the terms of the takeover, would lead to irreparable harm, customer confusion, and the like. And basically, the court shut it down. So basically, Zinger apparently can now sell wherever using Hebrew and Arabic only. I guess he couldn't use English as part of the settlement. And that's where it stands now. I mean, I assume you've dealt with the issue in your other job.
Yeah, well, JCRC, AJC, I mean, this whole idea of normalization, and then if you allow ice cream to be sold, like the boycott, the BDS movement, this whole idea that, you know, if you do something normal, like you allow Israelis and Palestinians and Jews to have ice cream, that, you know, that's sort of normalizing the occupation or normalizing a bad situation and an imbalance of power. It's so problematic because I'm into building relationships. That's what we want, more relationships. And the closer the relationships and the more people do things together, that's how you move towards peace. And that's how you move towards empowerment, including empowerment of Palestinians. So it
employed like 2,000 people in 4 different plants.
Yeah. And this is, I remember SodaStream was involved with this also.
Right.
Noah Tishby has in her book talks about this, that it just hurts Palestinians. It just would mean that Palestinians could not buy Ben and Jerry's. And now with this new deal, they can. And I think my hunch is, and though I didn't talk to the judge, but my hunch is that when the judge saw this and said that, oh, by Ben and Jerry's, you know, having their brand in Hebrew and Arabic, which is great, and left Hebrew and Arabic on it, what's a better symbol of shared society than that? That's causing irreparable harm to their reputation of being moral or ethical or socially conscious. No, that's Dafka, we would say. That's specifically what you want to do. This judge must have said, what is going on here? And I think that's the whole BDS movement. It's really about, you know, boycott, divest, sanction, but it's really about demonization of Israel and Jews, and that they would rather, I'm going to say it. I don't think they care about Palestinians. They don't care about anybody. They just want to harm Israel. They just want to fight Israel. And some of it, unfortunately, I think are Jewish people that feel very guilty. Israel is a great state, is powerful. And Israel, the truth is, the Palestinians have been, are in a bad state. And I don't think it's really Israel's fault. I'm very sympathetic towards the Palestinian people, and I want there to be shared society with Israel and coexistence. But the way to do it is not by beating up on the Israelis or the Jews, and certainly not by harming Palestinians to do it. So this judge, God bless her, you know, I think she really got it. And I'm sure they're going to still sue some more. And, you know, I don't know, they'll go take it to the Supreme Court. You know, Coney Barrett or whatever. I don't think it's going to be that sympathetic to this. Or
and for the record, I also come from a line of, you know, my father won an award in the late 70s for Israel bonds. And my dad was a Holocaust survivor. Imagine he gives up. And I've read the speech, and I have the speech where he gave, in his speech, basically a presentation where he certainly talked about Israel, but also talked about the Palestinians and how they deserve rights. And that was for a speech in the late 70s at an Israel bond dinner, talk about potentially divisive. And yet he had the moral compass to be able to say that he thought the Palestinians should have a right to, you know, to live free and the like. And so I would agree with you 100%. You know, I think that we can talk about the Israeli-Palestinian issue on a whole nother podcast, but I think we can put a pin in the fact that both of us want for them what we want for our people as well. You know, one question I have for you is, when you have a situation like this should it impact their kosher status? In other words, if you had a company like this that, let's say the decision stood and they were basically pulling out of Israel entirely, they were engaged in a BDS program with respect to their food, would that be something that you think should impact the kosher status?
No, so I it's a great question. And it goes back, there are two interesting cases. One is the Glot Yacht, the famous Glot Yacht from, I think, the probably the late 80s, maybe the early 90s. This was a kosher cruise that went around the New York Harbor, and it was glot kosher, means super kosher. We can talk about the technicalities, but glot means super kosher. But it was a yacht, and there was dancing on board. It was just a great time, but you know, mixed dancing, men and women. And
this is the Jewish love boat.
Exactly. So, and that's a, you know, there are, you know, laws about mixed dancing. And so they pressured the supervising agency not to, to pull the supervision, which was just about food. And it wasn't, and, but they said, well, since there's mixed dancing, we cannot give our supervision. I don't agree with that at all. And in fact, I admire supervising agencies that are courageous. So we went to a same-sex wedding, our whole family, a couple of months ago, and it was a kosher wedding. And I would never want the supervising agency to say, well, we can't give our, you know, we can't declare it kosher because we disagree, you know, whether that's a whole discussion in Judaism, but we disagree with a same-sex marriage. I wouldn't want them to be able to say that. And so I thanked the supervisor there. I said, thank you for making this kosher. And in fact, when I when we were going to the wedding, I said, when I saw him, and you can recognize me, I'm usually a big beard and a big kippah. And I said, you know, everything's kosher. He says, the food is kosher. But that's, I think that's so important. And I remember in Israel, apparently there was a supervising agency that pulled their hashgacha, pulled their supervision, because from a yogurt, apparently, because there was a dinosaur on the yogurt and they didn't believe in dinosaurs or something, you know, because it would imply that the world is more than 57, 82 years old. So they pulled it. So no, I as much as I would love to say that they shouldn't be given supervision, all that, let the supervising agencies just see that, you know, that it's the ingredients and the care and everything, the food is kosher. So that's what you'll see. I did it in Chicago. We did, like, around Christmas time, I would buy all these kosher Christmas cookies and Christmas this, you know, everything. Not that the OU is endorsing Christmas, but just that, you know, that's like living in America, that, you know, their job is to make sure that the food is kosher. Don't worry, let people make the decision how they're going to use their Christmas cookies or whatever, how they're going to celebrate their weddings.
Now, I assume a step too far would be the neighborhood in which Anshei Shalom sat, where they had various very interesting stores, including some that sold erotic pasta. I'll just leave it at that and let everybody's minds go where they may. I assume that's where you might draw the line, or you probably never get to the point where any of those people who sold those particular kinds of pasta would even ask.
Right. It's interesting though. Look, there, that is a challenge, and how far you could push it. I mean, definitely the OU was getting involved. The OU is a big supervising, kosher supervising agency, was getting involved in marijuana and like brownies, like, you know, who gives supervision for Duncan Hines? Well, if Duncan Hines had a, you know, brownie with some, you know, I don't know, cannabis or something, which they don't, as far as I know, but the OU was actually was going to give supervision to some product because it's legal, and wherever it's legal, like in Michigan, it's legal. But
make me give my hour-long presentation on marijuana legal on the state fronts and not legal on the federal fronts, because that way we'll turn this into a very different kind of podcast that we'll lose listeners even faster than we would after talking about Bris.
Yes, I know. But, you know, it is, you know, the actually, My son, Judah, who's now studying, we dropped him off this past week in Israel. He's studying at the Gush. So he was trying to close down a, one of the restaurants in Detroit. And here, like the supervising agency, the VOD, the committee that supervises, known to be very strict, but they have some live music in the restaurant on Monday nights. No mixed dancing, but live music. And actually, there is a law on the books in the code of laws that says that you shouldn't be listening, except at a wedding or something like that, you shouldn't be listening to live music while you're eating. And he, my son, God bless him, he challenged, like, why is this a restaurant? And the kashrut agency, they said, the supervisor said, you know, we just vouch for the food, the steak. We don't vouch for all the other things that people are doing. And I think, you know, that's sort of like this theme of at college, in college also. I think it goes back to our theme of back to school, that we have to have a lot of tolerance for people. You know, we need, there are certain things that we need. We can't be subjected to racism or anti-Semitism or Islamophobia or something like that. That's unfair. On the other hand, there are things that might trigger us in certain ways, and we just have to be tolerant of that. You know, kosher, like I cannot eat, you know, we cannot eat a non-kosher steak, but if there's music playing in the background or if there's erotic pasta with it, then, you know, we have to learn how to deal with those triggers, those microaggressions.
Boy, we've covered a lot on this podcast, that's for sure.
Well, you know, so I think we have to leave in a moment, but I know, John, you wanted to talk again about Elul a little bit, about this month of Elul, which we did touch on.
Yeah, there's all sorts of neat traditions that I don't think people appreciate. Like in the morning, in the Shacharit service, the shofar is blown every morning to get you into that mood. And there are certain psalms that need to be said, 27. And Slichot, and certain penitential prayers are said, and there's customs to visit the graves. All these things, I suppose, are part of that entire process you mentioned of getting us prepared to hit that summit that is Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry, when you mentioned about visiting graves, your dear friend Rosie Mock of blessed memory, she was a congregant in Chicago, and she was German. She was from Wiesbaden, I think, and her husband worked for Spiegels, so she would love talking German to you, I think.
Well, and my dad knew him, because my dad was at Spiegel.
Right. So, yeah, her husband was not Siegfried, but Siegbert. Siegbert, I think.
That's right.
Yeah. So, but anyway, she would never go into a cemetery. She just felt she'd be too overcome with emotion. So that's sort of the idea that you're mentioning is we try to do things in this month of Elul that really get us worked up a little bit. And, you know, like we mentioned before, God is around more. So feeling that presence of God more, hearing the shofar, this ram's horn blowing, which is sort of a very primitive sound, really. It's not a fine trumpet or trombone, but it's like a primitive sound. And even that Psalm 27 is so interesting. If you look at it, it's all about being with God. A lot of the theme is being with God, but it's also about a battle and a struggle. And I always like to say, to tell my congregants or people, anyone who will listen, actually, maybe it's not my congregants, but anyone, you know, well, they're great. But anyone will listen, that it's sort of a struggle to come to ourselves sometimes. Sometimes we're just not ready to open up, and we're not ready to, you know, face the demons that we have inside of us, or face the, you know, imperfections. And this is about the battle that we need to have to really open up and to understand the truth about ourselves. Just saying this makes me a little bit scared, but
powerful stuff.
Yes, there we go. Well, a little bit of Glenn Livett and being inspired with you, John, and, you know, really, and now, like you said, we're old folks. We both of us have one kid at home, and we're nearly empty nesters. So,
and pretty soon we're going to be doing this podcast from the rocking chair.
Yes, exactly. And I'll tell you, coming up, we're gonna talk more about having guests. But one thing I would love is talking to my wife Rachel. Maybe we can have our wives be some of our first guests on it, and they're both doing very interesting things. So
I would love to, but my only concern is that our listeners are going to like them more than us.
Okay, aren't you a libertarian? It's a free market, you know. Free competition, it makes you better.
The free marketplace of ideas. And I'm worried that our ideas are going to lose that race, but we'll see.
It'll make us better people.
Indeed. Just like they did for us.
So, John, this is great. It's always a lot of fun. And thanks, everyone, for listening and for tell your friends about it. And, John, I'll let you, you opened up. I'll let you close.
All right. I guess the best way to close would be have a very meaningful Elul, and we'll see you soon.
Excellent. Take Thanks. Care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of A Rabbi and a Lawyer Walk into a Bar. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to get our next episode delivered right to you. If you really like us, please consider leaving a review and sharing this with a friend. That would really help our efforts. And finally, to contact us and for more show-related information, please visit our website, rabbilawyerbar.com. Special thanks to our production team, David Stone for the introduction music, Andrew Bauman for the artwork, and I'm Nicholas Tantillo. This podcast is co-produced with Front and Social Studios in Chicago. Disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent. Copyrighted material, all rights reserved.